gun. If I see a copper, I'll shoot Rory.
You wouldn't hurt Rory.
How would you know? I've killed babies before.
Don't say that, Aggie. Just come in.
Not this time.
I muffle a sob with my fist.
Hayden?
Yeah.
These past weeks, with you and Rory, have been the happiest of my life.
Mine too,
he says. And I believe him.
Megan. Arriving at Chiswick Police Station, we're taken directly to McAteer's office on the second floor and told to wait. Through slatted blinds, I view the incident room, where dozens of detectives are on the phones or poring over train timetables and CCTV footage. The helter-skelter of activity should bolster me, but I'm beyond reassurance. McAteer's voice echoes across the room.
There are 3 million fucking cameras in this city, and you're telling me not one of them has picked her up.
He kicks at a chair, which rolls into a bin. Detectives keep their heads down, not wanting to make eye contact. The DCS is issuing orders.
Tell the Imperial War Museum we want full access to their control room and security cameras. Front office staff will be replaced by undercover officers, and the public have to be kept away from the foyer.
How do we do that without alerting her? Asks a detective.
I don't care. Just do it.
McAteer is walking and talking.
We need eyes on her as soon as possible, which means putting plainclothes officers at the nearest train stations and bus stops. They're to follow from a distance. Nobody, I repeat, nobody, approaches her until we have the SWAT teams in place. Is that understood?
Nods all round. McAteer has reached the office. He shakes Jack's hand and smiles at me, trying to be reassuring.
Thank you for coming.
As though we had a choice.
How much have you been told?
Agatha called her fiancé, says Jack.
We've traced the signal to a southwest train travelling between Wandsworth Station and Clapham Junction at 6:24 this morning. By the time we intercepted the train, it had reached Waterloo Station. She wasn't on board.
What about Ben? I ask.
We believe he's with her.
Is she going to give him back?
She says she'll hand Ben over to you. She wasn't clear on the time, but we think she's heading to the Imperial War Museum.
Why there?
I ask. It's where Hayden Cole took her on their first date.
McAteer glances at a message on his phone.
We're going to put a female officer in your clothes, someone with the same build and hair colour.
But Agatha knows what I look like, I say.
I'm not putting you in danger.
Won't she get angry if someone else shows up?
It won't be an issue.
How can you say that?
I look at Jack, hoping he might back me up.
Come on.
He remains silent. McAteer continues. We believe Agatha Fifel spent last night at a supermarket in Barnes. She entered after hours and disabled the alarm system. An employee reported the break-in at 6 this morning when he arrived for work. Somebody stole nappies, baby formula and food. The manager had a handgun locked in a drawer below the cash register. The gun's now missing, which is why I won't risk putting you anywhere near this woman.
Agatha wouldn't shoot me.
You don't know that. I begin to argue, but McAteer cuts me off. 5 years ago, Agatha was interviewed about the abduction of a baby girl in Brighton. Although never considered to be a serious suspect, she was traced by officers using accommodation records to locate any visitors to Brighton that weekend.
The baby was never found, I say, the words like cotton in my mouth.
How do you know that? Asks Jack.
I heard the mother being interviewed on the radio. Emily. That was the baby's name.
Anxiety expands in my chest like a balloon.
I picture the stone markers found beside the canal near Leeds. What did Agatha do? Did she panic and hide the evidence? What will she do if I don't show up?
McAteer answers a knock on the door. A car is waiting to take him to the Imperial War Museum.
Please let me come, I beg. Ben's going to need me.
It's safer if you stay here, he says.
You either take me or you arrest me.
The detective looks at Jack, hoping for a supporter. Jack raises his palms as though opting out of the debate. If I were you, I wouldn't argue with my wife.
Agatha. At Clapham Junction, I catch a train to Three Bridges in West Sussex before changing platforms and taking a London-bound service to Victoria. The city passes the window, railway workshops, besmirched brick walls, and pitted tarmac car parks that give way to terraced houses and blocks of flats. A blur of blue, white, and yellow rushes past in the opposite direction, making the windows rattle and the air pressure change. Unwrapping a new SIM card, I slide it into my phone, pressing it on. The screen lights up. I call another number. There are phantom clicks on the line. A woman answers. "I'd like to speak to Megan Shaughnessy," I say. "Are you a reporter?" "No." "Are you a friend of hers?" She knows me. "Mrs. Shaughnessy is busy at the moment. I can take a message. Tell her it's Agatha." The woman on the phone seems to choke on her own saliva. "Please hold," she says, covering the phone. I can still hear what she's saying. "It's her. Trace the signal. Let the boss know." She uncovers the handset. "She's coming now." "You're lying. Put her on or I'll hang up." "She's upstairs." "No, she's not." The phone is covered again. I hear muffled voices, instructions. "Here she is," says the woman. Meg is breathing hard. "It's me." "Are they listening?"
"No."
"Don't lie to me."
"Yes, I'm sorry."
"Is Ben all right?"
"He's fine."
"They said he was sick."
"He's better now."
There is a pause. The silence weighs more heavily on Meg.
"The police say you're going to give him up."
"Only to you."
"Can it be someone else?"
"No."
"They say you have a gun."
"I'm not going to shoot you."
"The police don't know that."
Another silence. I take a deep breath and begin to explain. Meg interrupts.
"You're on a train. You could leave Ben at the ticket office or give him to a conductor."
"No."
"But if you did that..."
"You're not listening," I say sharply. She apologizes. I begin again, unsure where to start. Perhaps it doesn't matter. Maybe Meg will never understand what it's like to be me. She grew up in a loving family and went to the best schools and then to university. She got a dream job working for a women's magazine, where she got to flirt with Jude Law over lunch. She married a handsome, successful man and fell pregnant at the drop of a hat. How can she ever understand my life? What it's like to live in a cramped, claustrophobic tunnel that gets smaller and darker as each year passes. There's no light at the end, no paradise, no rest. I am stuck in this squalid, fetid hole with a creature that slithers in my guts, telling me I don't deserve the light, that I am not a real woman because I cannot have a baby. I don't know if I've said any of this out loud, but I realize that I'm still talking as the train crosses the Thames, and the water below me swirls and eddies around the pylons of Chelsea Bridge, foaming and bubbling on the outgoing tide. A clipped female voice comes over the intercom.
"We are now approaching London Victoria."
The train breaks, the metal wheels squealing. Meg will have heard it. So will the police. I feel as though I'm trapped between two worlds, the past and the present. I cannot see beyond today because others, luckier than me, have taken my future and left me no room. "If you want your baby, you have to come and get him. I'm not giving him to anyone else." Megan. By the time the police reached Victoria Station, Agatha had slipped away into the maze of crowded walkways, corridors and exits that lead to other lines or onto the street. Now they're studying the CCTV footage from dozens of cameras, hoping to discover which way she went. Three tube lines intersect at Victoria, as well as an overland service that brings tens of thousands of people into the West End every day. Wipers thrash and sirens wail. From inside the police car, the noise sounds strangely muted, and it takes me a moment to realize that we are the source of the sound, making heads turn and cars pull aside. Traffic is stretched back for more than half a mile along Westminster Bridge Road on the approach to the Imperial War Museum. Motorcycle outriders have joined us, ahead and behind, unblocking intersections and finding a route through the bottlenecks. Lisa Jane is behind the wheel, with Cyrus in the front passenger seat. Jack and I sit in the rear. He reaches out and takes my hand, lacing his fingers through mine. I keep remembering my conversation with Agatha, replaying it in my mind, looking for some new detail that might help. She said she was sorry, which is a good sign. "Did she sound rational?" asks Jack, as though reading my thoughts. "I don't think she's crazy." "Of course she is. She faked a pregnancy and stole a baby. And fooled everyone. Clever people can be crazy." Cyrus doesn't comment, but I suspect he agrees with me. In all of our dealings, he has never used words like crazy or deranged or delusional when referring to Ben's kidnapper. Agatha has always been a victim in Cyrus's mind, something Jack will never accept. He's forever denouncing psychologists and psychiatrists for creating the age of victimhood, where everyone finds someone else to blame for their problems, rather than take any personal responsibility.
"We need to talk about what happens next," says Cyrus, turning in his seat. "DCS McAteer won't put you in danger. It's more than his job is worth. But Agatha may insist on speaking to you. If that happens, you need to have answers ready."
"What sort of answers?"
"She may want to test you. She may change her mind. You have to be ready to convince her."
I nod.
"First and foremost, you ask to see Ben. It's called proof of life. You have to be sure that she has him."
"Okay."
Agatha's likely to be anxious and frightened. She may seem calm, but have conflicting emotions, particularly at the handover. When she sees someone pick up the baby, she'll realize that she won't see him again. That's when she could change her mind.
"What do I do then?"
"Keep her calm. Engage with her. Listen when she's talking. Show that you understand. Agatha will want to dictate the terms, but you can start to move her."
"How?"
"By winning her trust," says Cyrus. "It may help if you refer to the baby as Rory rather than Ben, because that's who he is to Agatha. She has looked after him ever since he was born. Giving him up will be hard."
"Do I ask her about the gun?"
"No."
"What if she doesn't want to give him up?"
"Encourage her gently. Ask about the baby. How is he sleeping and feeding? Tell her she's done a great job."
I nod.
"The police will have marksmen training their weapons on Agatha. If they get a clear shot and they see her become agitated, they may decide to take her down. You cannot interfere with this."
"I don't want anyone getting shot."
"Which is why you have to keep her calm."
"What if she won't give him to the policewoman? What if it has to be me?"
"DCS McAteer will have to make that call. At some point, Ben has to be handed over. That's the most crucial moment. Either Agatha's resolve will crumble, or she'll fight back."
"Will she hurt him?" asks Jack.
Cyrus shakes his head. "But she will die for him."
The police car pulls up on Lambeth Road. A constable opens the door for me and holds an umbrella over my head. A police helicopter is hovering above us, visible between the bare branches of the trees. I hear a loud hailer telling people that the museum is closed and to move away from the area. We are taken along a path and up a short set of stairs between two enormous guns that are pointing north towards the Thames. DCS McAteer is waiting in the marbled foyer. I look past him into a vast room where old-fashioned warplanes are suspended from the ceiling, as though frozen in mid-flight. I recognize the V-1 and V-2 rockets, as well as a Spitfire, which swoops overhead as though ready to strafe unwanted visitors. The interconnecting halls rise 100 feet to a domed ceiling that is flanked by staircases that turn back and forth up to the higher levels. I am taken into an anteroom and then into an administration office, which has become the control room. Cyrus is talking to a woman with hair similar to mine, who has been dressed in a skirt, blouse and overcoat. She's about my size with the same complexion, but nobody would ever mistake us.
"She's not going to fool anyone," I tell McAteer when he breaks from a huddle of plain-clothed detectives.
"The officer is a trained negotiator.
What if you make her angry?
I know what I'm doing.
McAteer reaches into a box and produces a bulletproof vest. Is that necessary?
Everyone has to wear one.
The vest is lighter than I expect. I pull it over my blouse and he clips the straps, pulling them tight.
Can you breathe?
I nod. Won't Agatha see all the police cars and the helicopter?
I can't risk putting people in danger.
What if she runs?
We're sealing off the area.
A man approaches, dressed in black overalls. He's so laden with body armor that I doubt if he can swing his arms. Through an open doorway, I notice at least 8 more men in identical clothes. They are moving out, some taking the stairs, which zigzag back and forth as they climb to the higher levels of the museum. Others take up positions behind pillars or against walls. The SWAT leader briefs McAteer.
I have one team covering the main doors from the cloakroom, another is covering the foyer and main hall. What about outside? We have firearms officers on the roof and others deployed in the grounds dressed as gardeners and council workers. Their default aiming position is the upper torso, center of mass, but we can go for a headshot if she's carrying the baby across her chest.
Without thinking, I cry, please don't shoot anyone. The men turn.
Go back to your husband, Mrs. Shaughnessy, says McAteer.
Let me talk to her, I plead. Nobody has to get hurt.
We have this under control.
Lisa Jane is told to escort me back to the anteroom office, where I argue with Jack. He doesn't seem to care what happens to Agatha. Before any of this happened, before Ben was taken, and the harsh media spotlight lit up our small corner of the world, my life had been comfortable and untroubled. A well-worn middle-class progression that felt like a dream run, but could have been a rut. How dare I complain? I was born in the right time and right place, to the right family. I met a man and we built a life together, yet sometimes, even the most charmed existence can change in the blink of an eye, or turn on the length of an eyelash. One moment of indecision. A cancer cell, a rogue gene, a wrong turn, a red light, a drunk driver, a cruel piece of misfortune. Every time I close my eyes, I picture Agatha walking towards the museum, aware that she's being watched. She is carrying my baby in a sling across her chest. The foyer is empty. She sees a woman who looks a little like me from a distance, but soon becomes someone else. They argue. My surrogate tells Agatha to calm down. Agatha calls my name. She wraps her arms tightly around Ben. A red dot appears on her cheek and moves up her nose and onto her forehead. In a fleeting puff of blood and vapor, she spins and falls, carried down by gravity, striking her head on the marble floor. I see the blood covering Ben's face. I don't hear him crying. My eyes open. The clock doesn't seem to have moved. I'm sweating beneath the bulletproof vest. Lisa Jane brings me a glass of water, but I cannot swallow. Minutes pass slowly. 11:04. 11:05. 11:06. Where is she? There have been no sightings of Agatha from the offices outside. McAteer has spoken twice to the police commissioner, who wants to know how long the operation is going to last. He takes another call. I only hear one side of the conversation, which involves a lot of cursing and threats.
What's happened? Asks Jack when the call ends. Hayden Cole jumped out of the police car at Fulham Palace Road 45 minutes ago.
Agatha. The carriage is full of men in suits and women in dark overcoats and winter boots. Day shifts and night shifts are blended together. Fresh faces and tired faces, the showered and the soiled. A boy opposite me is wearing an England shirt and paint-speckled jeans. He slouches lower with man-spread knees, his head rocking from side to side as he gently snores. I look out the window, aware of how drab the world has become, how grey and turgid and run-of-the-mill. It carries on blithely ignoring my plight, because I have no weight or consequence. How do people do it? Keep going. Why do they make the effort? I hold Rory on my lap,
letting him sleep in the crook of my left arm. My right hand is in the pocket of my coat where I've put the gun. I'm sweating in the overheated carriage, but I will not take off my coat, because I do not trust the police to do as I've asked. The creature is awake. Foolish girl, foolish girl, foolish girl.
I'm doing the right thing.
By giving up.
I'm not his mother.
You're the only mother he's ever known.
He's not mine.
He could be. Turn around. Run.
Where?
Most of the commuters get off at Canary Wharf and Heron Keys. Only the tourists and sightseers remain by the time we cross under the Thames. The train slows again. Stops. I loop the colourful cotton sling around my neck and hold Rory close to my chest as I step onto a crowded platform and ride the long escalator up into the daylight. Rain is falling. I don't have an umbrella. Tilting my face, I feel a thousand tiny spines of raindrops melting on my cheeks, clinging to my hair and eyelashes. I wrap one side of my overcoat around Rory and keep moving, weaving between shoulders, head down, hood up. As I walk along the avenue of trees, I notice how the branches almost meet in the middle of the road. Across the gravel forecourt, I glimpse the Maritime Museum through the railing fence. The cream and pink stucco facade has been darkened by the day, looking gloomy rather than grand. Just visible through the colonnades, the Royal Observatory is etched sharply against the grey. Hayden once took a photograph of me straddling the Prime Meridian line, the meeting point of East and West. He told me I was standing at the centre of time. Where are the police, I wonder? I expected them to be waiting. Maybe they're hiding. I imagine SWAT teams behind the darkened windows and sharpshooters on the roof. Shortly after 11, I walk through the main doors, past the information desk and the cloakroom. There are parties of schoolchildren queuing up, dressed in blazers and boater hats and brightly polished shoes. Heads must be counted, names must be crossed off. The officious-looking head teacher is a sour-faced woman in a black flared skirt and thick stockings. She treats them like prisoners instead of students. I stop and look around me. Nobody seems to be watching me. I glance at Rory, who is sucking his thumb. "Why am I giving you back?" I whisper. "They're not even here." Exhausted, I take a seat on one of the island benches and turn on my phone, calling Megan's number. She answers nervously. "Where are you?" I ask. "Waiting." "So am I." There is a pause. She asks me to hold on. I can hear her walking and opening a door, closing it, whispering. "Are you at the Imperial War Museum?" "No. I'm in Greenwich, at the National Maritime Museum." Megan is flustered now. "We thought... you were supposed... we've been waiting..." "Why would Hayden send them to the wrong place?" "I've been here all along," I tell her. "Please... please, I'm coming," she says. "Don't go anywhere. Where will you be?" "There's a painting I love. It's in the Special Exhibitions Gallery. I'll wait for you there." At that moment, I hear a voice behind me, and I end the call. "Hello, Aggie." I turn slowly, reaching into my pocket for the gun. "What are you doing here?" Nerves are sparking in Hayden's eyes. He's dressed in jeans, a leather jacket, and a baseball cap with the price tag still attached. Unshaven and red-eyed, he looks as though he hasn't slept. Glancing down, he sees the top of Rory's head, just visible behind the folds of my coat. "How is he?"
"Getting better."
"That's good."
"Why are you here?"
"Can we go for a walk?" he asks.
"Why? I don't understand."
"Please, Aggie. I'll explain outside. You go first." Doing as he asks, I retrace my steps, up the stairs and out the main doors, before turning left along the path. Glancing over my shoulder, I see Hayden walking 20 yards behind me, his hands deep in his pockets and collar turned up. I wait for him under a canopy of bare branches. He steps closer and cups my head in his hands. I flinch, thinking he might be angry. But he leans closer and kisses me gently,
holding his lips on mine until I breathe in his sigh. His arms slip around me, and I press my head against his chest.
What are you doing here?
I came to help. Stepping back, he unbuttons my coat, reaching inside until he brushes his thumb over Rory's cheek. His fingers are cold. Rory's eyes open momentarily and close again.
I'm going to miss him,
says Hayden, his voice thick with emotion.
Are the police going to charge you?
He shrugs.
I'll tell them it wasn't your fault.
It doesn't matter.
Please tell your parents that I'm sorry.
You gave them a grandchild. You gave me a son.
And now I'm giving him back.
That's why I'm here.
I don't understand.
He looks nervously over his shoulder, studying the entrance to the park and the surrounding streets.
We don't have much time. I sent the police to the wrong museum, but it won't take them long to realize.
He slides his hands behind my neck and loosens the knot on the sling.
What are you doing?
I'm taking Rory.
Why would you do that?
So you can run.
Run where?
You can get away.
He pulls a bundle of cash out of his pocket.
This is £5,000. It's all I have.
He holds out the money, wanting me to take it.
I can't run. My face will be on every TV screen and newspaper. They'll be watching the ports and airports.
I have a Navy mate who's on the same ship as me, but he won't be home until mid-January. I have the keys to his flat in Portsmouth. You can hide there for a few weeks. I can bring you food.
A few weeks isn't long enough.
It'll give us time to think of another plan.
They'll find me eventually.
Hayden's face twists.
I'm trying to help you, Aggie. I know what you did was wrong, but you're giving Rory back. He's fine. You don't deserve to be punished for this.
But I do. No, no. You were hurting.
Lonely.
The police told me about you being abused, your teenage pregnancy and the adoption. That wasn't your fault.
I've done other things.
Hayden raises his face to the rain and groans, as though wanting to scream in frustration.
I took another woman's baby,
I whisper.
You weren't to blame. I tricked you. I'm sorry. Now I'm giving him back.
Okay, but let me do it for you, he says, pleading with me.
This is not your mistake.
I love you, Aggie. I didn't want to fall in love, but I couldn't help myself. I know you think it was just because of Rory and me becoming a father, but that's only part of it. I fell in love with you.
I try to say something, but he doesn't give me the chance.
Why do you think I kept quiet about your mother not being at the birth when the police asked? When I couldn't contact the midwife? I knew what you'd done. I knew that Rory wasn't ours, but I didn't want to give him up. I wish you'd told me earlier, but then he got sick and we didn't have a choice. When you ran off from the surgery, I tried to stop Dr. Shaw calling the police. I vouched for you. I said that I'd seen you breastfeeding and that we had a proper birth certificate. I lied for you. I lied for us. But I couldn't stop him.
His voice cracks.
They're going to send you to prison, Aggie.
You don't deserve that. Take the money. Run. Go to my mate's place. In a few weeks, I'll find somewhere else for you to go.
I can't run,
I whisper.
Of course you can. People run all the time. They disappear. I can keep you hidden. We're going to lose your little boy, Aggie, but we don't have to lose each other.
Hayden pauses, searching for the right words, reaching for them, coming up empty. He tries again.
This doesn't have to be the end. We'll give the baby back. You can plead guilty. Tell the jury you were obsessed, mad with desire for a baby. The judge will show mercy. At most you'll serve 2, maybe 3 years, and then you'll be free. We're still young. We can get married and have our own baby.
I reach out and brush his unshaven cheek, calling him a silly boy.
I can't have children.
Right, okay, but we can adopt a baby. I don't mind. Rory isn't mine, but I still love him.
Nobody will ever let me adopt a baby. Not after what I've done.
Hayden rocks from side to side, pulling at his ears, desperately searching for answers. I'm the cause of his pain.
Go home, my love. They'll be here soon.
But nobody knows where you are.
I told them.
What?
I called Meg. I told her they were at the wrong place.
Hayden looks over his shoulder again, with more urgency now. Quick! Give me Rory. We can still do this.
No.
Ignoring me, he takes his right arm from the sleeve of his jacket and holds Rory against his chest before refastening the buttons, concealing the baby completely.
They'll think you were involved, I say, trying to stop him.
The police will lay charges. You'll lose your commission, your career.
I've hurt you enough already.
I don't care. I'm leaving the Navy. None of it matters.
Yes, it does.
Hayden's eyes are swimming. Please, Aggie. Why won't you run?
This is my mistake, not yours.
I won't let you risk everything for me. He isn't listening. He doesn't understand what I've done, what happened to the other babies, or what I did to Nikki, the lives I've ruined. I grab his arm, clasping the empty leather sleeve of his jacket. He flicks me away. I reach out again, calling Rory's name. Give him back! I yell.
Let me help you. Nobody can help me.
The creature uncoils. Stupid, stupid, stupid girl. He's stealing him.
He'll never do that.
He wants Rory for himself.
He loves me.
He's lying. My fingers have found the pistol. I pull it free. My vision is fractured by tears, and I can barely recognize my own voice, which rises from the depths of my chest, shaking with disappointment or grief.
Give him back to me!
Hayden hesitates, staring at the gun. Don't do this, Aggie. Shoot him.
He loves me.
Nobody could ever love you.
You're wrong.
Hayden hands Rory over without saying another word. He turns and walks away, wiping something from his eyes. Megan. The rain has turned to sleet, angling across the windows of the cab like wind-blown gobs of spit. Tires swish beneath me, and classical music plays on the cab radio, Vivaldi's Four Seasons, Winter. A different storm rages within me. We were sent to the wrong place. Did Hayden Cole do it on purpose, or was it a mistake? I'm alone in the cab, but it won't take them long to realize I'm missing. They'll send someone to the bathroom to search for me, or Jack will raise the alarm. I told nobody about Agatha's phone call. Instead, I excused myself and managed to shake Lisa Jane as McAteer stood his men down. Hayden Cole was in the back seat of a police car being driven to the Imperial War Museum when he told police he was going to be sick. The escorting officers lowered a rear window. Hayden squeezed out before they could react. The police gave chase, but lost him in Fulham Palace Road Cemetery. I don't know why Hayden ran, but he's become a fugitive, just like Agatha. Right now, I'm certain of only one thing. My baby is in Greenwich. I promised Agatha I'd come alone. I'm keeping this promise, because I don't want anyone to get hurt, but the doubts are creeping in. What if I'm wrong? What if Agatha and Hayden had this planned all along? The cab is passing through South London. Outside I see drab grey shop fronts and blocks of flats that no amount of Christmas decorations and coloured lights can make cheerful. I used to love this city, the plain trees and bridges and cathedrals and monuments. I loved its narrow streets and quaint shops and grand gardens. That hasn't changed. But I could leave London tomorrow, and not miss it, as long as I had my family with me. People, not places, make a life whole. I roll my head against the glass.
You all right, love?
Asks the cabbie.
Yes, thank you.
You look familiar.
I'm nobody.
The cab drops me on Romney Road, and I step over puddles to reach the footpath. Despite the rain, crowds of tourists are queuing to visit the Cutty Sark. A Japanese tour group marches past me, carrying matching umbrellas, following a guide into Greenwich Royal Park. My mobile's ringing.
Where the hell are you?
Asks Jack.
I'm getting Ben.
Are you crazy?
He's yelling to someone, McAteer most likely, whose blood pressure will be stratospheric. Where are you? Tell me.
I'll be fine. Agatha wants to give him back.
She has a gun, for God's sake.
Nobody has to get hurt.
Listen to me, Meg. Don't do this. Tell me where you are.
I'll call you when it's over.
I hang up and turn off my phone. The woman at the ticket desk offers me a visitor's map of the museum, but I ask for directions to the special exhibitions gallery.
It's on the lower ground floor, she says, before interrupting herself. You're that woman from the TV, the one whose baby got taken. No, that's not me.
My knees are shaking as I take the stairs and cross the marble floor, looking between pillars and display cases of naval uniforms and artifacts. A lone figure sits on an island bench seat in the middle of a cavernous room. My shoes squeak on the polished floor. Agatha raises her eyes and blinks back tears. I notice the sling across her chest, but can't see Ben.
What took you so long? She asks, looking behind me, as though expecting to see the police.
There was a misunderstanding. Hayden sent you to the wrong place.
Why?
It doesn't matter now. I feel the weight of the silence, but not the sadness, because I have eyes only for the sling around Agatha's chest. She reaches across her body and pulls it aside. I see a small, pale face with enormous eyes that seem to open at the sound of my voice. They trap us like that, babies. With one look, they can take hold of our hearts, because our hearts have no defenses against such beauty and fragility. Ben utters a weak squawk, and as if by magic, my breasts begin to ache, and my milk comes in. I forget everything Cyrus told me about keeping my distance, and stumble forward, kneeling beside Agatha. He's hungry, she says. I don't have another bottle.
I could feed him, I say, hopefully.
She ponders this, and nods. Getting up, I begin to unbutton my coat. Agatha sees the Kevlar vest, but doesn't say anything.
Can you help?
I ask. She loosens the straps and I pull the vest over my head, dropping it on the floor. At that moment, I glimpse the handgun tucked into the pocket of her coat. I look at Agatha, waiting for a sign. She unties the knot behind her neck and lowers Ben into her lap.
You can take him.
Unbuttoning my blouse and unclipping my nursing bra, I slide my hands across her thighs and lift Ben to my breast, watching his lips part. He doesn't latch on. I brush the nipple against his top lip, encouraging him to open his mouth wider. It might take him a while, says Agatha, who is now holding the gun on her lap. At the fourth attempt, Ben locks on and sucks hard. His lips barely seem to move, but I can see him swallowing. Filled with joy and relief, my eyes brim over. I did not think. I dared not hope. I prayed. I wished. I did not give up. But now the emotion of the moment overwhelms me. Agatha reaches into her bag and finds me a tissue. I want to say I'm sorry for what I did, she says. I don't expect you to forgive me, but you should know that I've loved him as much as any mother could. It wasn't personal, by the way. I didn't take him because I wanted to hurt you or Jack. I idolized you. I wanted a life like yours. Our life isn't so perfect. It was to me. Jack and I let each other down all the time. Have you forgiven him for Rhea Bowden? I'm trying to, I say. Did you put the note on his windscreen? Agatha nods and gazes down at Ben. When I was growing up, I used to sit around with my girlfriends and talk about who we'd like to marry. We decided how many children we wanted and gave them preppy names like Jacinta and Rocco. All of us took it for granted that we'd get married and have babies. It was an automatic progression. School, a career, boyfriends, marriage, a mortgage and children. I would even draw sketches of myself and my perfect family and cut out pictures from magazines and stick them in a scrapbook. I gave myself a chic haircut and self-satisfied look, a handsome husband, a boy and a girl, a nice house in London or the home counties.
she could be describing my life. That was my fairy tale, and I didn't doubt it would come true. But I was wrong, and there's no one to blame. It wasn't my fault, or Nicky's. Agatha toys with the gun, turning it in her hands. It's not just the absence of a child, but everything that goes with it. The rites of parenthood, the mother's groups, school gate chats, Saturday sport on the sidelines, class dinners, school fundraisers and speech days. For you, these things are so commonplace, you don't give them a second thought. For me, they are everything I'll never have. I am an outlier. I am the incredible disappearing woman. I am childless, less of a person, not in the club. You take those things for granted. No, I don't. I've heard you complaining to the other wives. You're all the same. You tell each other about daily dramas, sleepless nights, lazy husbands, fussy eaters, messy rooms and food allergies. I used to hate you for that. She pauses. No, I'm sorry, hate is too strong a word. I thought you were ungrateful. They're just stories, I say. Everybody complains. I know I'm lucky and I know I shouldn't take my life for granted. But you do. I bet when you see a woman my age without children, you automatically wonder if she left it too long or put a career first. You think maybe she was too selfish or too choosy. I don't think that, I say. But in my heart, I know she's right. Feeling light-headed, I swap Ben between breasts. He belches quietly, leaving a thin trail of milk on my skin. I didn't have children to make you feel bad, Agatha. And it's not my fault that you couldn't have a baby, or you lost one. I know it's painful. I know you feel cheated, but you're not the first woman who couldn't fall pregnant, and infertility isn't the worst thing in the world. I'll tell you what's worse. Having a child go missing is worse. Lying awake at night, not knowing if he's alive or dead. You have an empty womb. I had an empty cradle. Mine is worse. Agatha's eyes flash. Would you swap your life for mine? I shake my head. I thought so. My thumb brushes over Ben's forehead. His eyes are open, and he's gazing at me, already falling in love. Agatha is right. Up until a few weeks ago, I had no idea what it was like to be infertile or to lose a child. I understand that now. What are you going to do? I ask. Agatha looks at the gun in her lap. I haven't decided. You could give that to me. She shakes her head. Please don't do anything foolish, Agatha. She sighs tiredly. I've been doing foolish things my entire life. Agatha. Meg rearranges her bra and buttons her blouse. Rory's fallen asleep on her lap, his belly full. You should go, I tell her. What about you? I'm going to stay here for a little while. You could come with me. No. Meg hesitates, wanting to argue, but she has what she came for. She says she understands how I feel, but I know that's not possible. She can sympathize, but not empathize. Few people can truly appreciate what it's like to give up a child. I was 15 when it happened to me, and I didn't just give up my newborn. I gave up the 1-year-old, and the 2-year-old, and the 3-year-old, and every other year-old that she became. I surrendered every Christmas morning, every visit from the Tooth Fairy and school concert, every Mother's Day, birthday, and kiss goodnight. How can Meg comprehend that? Maybe if she'd miscarried, or woken next to the marble-cold body of a baby girl, or lived with a cruel creature twisting inside her, she'd understand. Why should she have 3 children when you have none? That's her good fortune. She's one of them, part of the chorus. Meg isn't like that. She's everything you hate, a smug mummy blogger who is pandered to by advertisers and politicians. No, she said an empty cradle was worse than an empty womb. What she meant was, you wouldn't understand because you're not a mother. Arrogant bitch. Meg is sliding her arms into her coat.
She thinks her experience invalidates yours. She thinks she's better than you are.
No!
Stop her!
It's too late. I'm going to leave now, Meg says, holding Ben against her chest. Thank you for bringing him back.
I nod. She's staring at the gun.
Do you want to say goodbye?
I shake my head.
A single tear rolls down my cheek and falls onto my knuckles where I'm gripping the gun. The small, clear teardrop looks like a jeweled bead, magnifying the skin beneath, creating a tiny, curved reflection of the ceiling. Each step takes Meg further away.
She doesn't love Rory like you do. She doesn't know him. Take him back.
I can't.
Yes, you can. Raise the gun. Pull the trigger. It's easy.
She reaches the pillar and changes direction, heading towards the stairs. I look down at the gun. The single tear has rolled along my forefinger and brushed against the trigger. It is so strange, this life we lead. We search for happiness, but so much is about survival, existence. We try to manage expectations, but really we're treading water, wasting time, or contemplating lives we might have led. Pretty soon, we're like every other godless, money-hungry, backstabbing, jaded, jealous human being, wishing we were richer, prettier, younger, luckier, or could do it all over again. For me, there is no such thing as forgetting. I used to see a psychotherapist every week, Nikki's idea, who told me that I had to take all my negative thoughts and low self-esteem and lock them in a metal box, like a pirate's chest with multiple chains and padlocks. I had to bury this box deep in a desert so big that I could dig for 10,000 years and never find it. I tried to do that, but the memories seeped out like nuclear waste, with a half-life that lasts millennia. No matter how hard I try, the creature will always be with me, skulking at the edges of every clearing, waiting for the fire to burn down or the lights to go off, before creeping towards me. I can't even be sure these are my thoughts, or if the creature is thinking for me. I don't know how much of me there is left. Lowering the gun to my side, I walk slowly across the gallery until I'm standing in front of my favourite painting, Tahiti Revisited, looking at the palm trees and the warm river and the rocky peaks. I remember asking Hayden if one day he might take me there. But that won't happen now. Staring into the painting, I imagine myself dissolving into the canvas, appearing on the other side. 3 Polynesian women are bathing in the river, friends or sisters. One is swimming in the water, staring at the sky, while the others dry themselves on the shore, draping towels over a stone carving. The nearest woman has her back to me. Her buttocks are heavy, her breasts hidden, her skin tattooed. Slowly, gradually, I imagine my way into her body. I feel the water drying on my skin and the warmth of the sunshine on my shoulders. I glance at the thatched hut in the middle distance and raise my eyes to the rocky peak bathed in light. A little way off, just out of view, my babies are playing in the crushed coral sand, collecting shells and floating sticks on the tide. All of them are here. Lizzie, Emily, Chloe and Rory. Living in paradise, growing up and growing old, never being cold or hungry or lonely or scared. What is love, if not a trick of the light? Behind me, I hear heavy boots on the stairs, but I will not leave my island. I want to smell the tropical flowers, taste the fruit, and feel the sand between my toes. I wade into the warm water, feeling it creep above my knees and thighs.
"Drop your weapon," says an amplified voice.
Above my chest, up to my shoulders, caressing my skin.
"Drop your weapon!" You mean this old thing? I say, raising the gun to my temple. I would never...
Megan. We went to Mass on Christmas morning, walking across Barnes Green to St. Osmond's. It's not that we've suddenly become religious or undergone any sort of spiritual conversion, but I wanted to thank Father George and the community for all their prayers and good wishes. Maybe that's what Agatha has done for me. She's given me a reason to believe. I once dismissed faith because I viewed it from an intellectual standpoint, but faith has nothing to do with intellect. Equally, none of the kneeling and muttering of creeds provides any guarantee of contact with God. We can't register our prayers like a parcel and get a signature on delivery. After the Christmas service, we walk home, following the same path that we took on the evening of the candlelight vigil, along Church Road to Barnes Green. Jack pushes the pram with Ben, while Lachlan and Lucy run ahead. We're having Christmas at our place, and the house is already full of laughter and torn wrapping paper. My parents are here, along with Grace and her new boyfriend. Simon and Gina have also arrived, laden with presents for the kids. I'm cooking turkey with all the trimmings, cranberry sauce, roast chestnuts, sprouts, orange glazed carrots, pigs in blankets and roast potatoes. Brushing a damp hair from my forehead, I smile at Ben, who is sitting in a bassinet on the workbench, watching me make the bread sauce. They're playing charades in the sitting room. It's Lucy's turn and I know she's doing Frozen because she does it every time, and Lachlan guesses it first go. He comes running into the kitchen.
Mummy! Mummy! I guessed it! I guessed it!
Good for you. I wipe my hands on my apron. Come here, sweetie. I want you to open your mouth really wide.
Why?
I'm just going to rub this cotton swab around your cheek. It won't hurt. He shows me all his teeth, and I run the small cotton stick twice against the inside of his cheek before popping it into a plastic tube and screwing on the lid.
What's that for?
He says. Good luck, I say, ruffling his hair. Do you want some crisps? I hand him a bowl. Make sure you share them. Later, Simon comes in to see me. I know what he wants to ask. He leans over the bassinet, holding out a finger, which Ben reaches up and clasps tightly. That's some grip, he says, staring at the baby, trying to see some semblance of self or evidence of paternity. I take another cotton swab and place it against Ben's rosebud lips. He opens his mouth automatically, and I rub the stick around his cheek. Turning my back on Simon, I palm the swab and hand him the sample I collected earlier from Lachlan. Here it is, I say. Remember our deal. If he's yours, I tell Jack the truth. If he's not yours, you leave us alone. So think carefully before you go ahead and risk my marriage and your friendship. I have thought about it, says Simon, holding the sample up to the light, as though amazed that something so small and ordinary could wield such power. What have you decided to do? I ask. I'm going to try to get Gina pregnant, but I might hold on to this. Well, I don't know how long the sample is good for, but this is a one-off opportunity. Simon looks at me with a sparkle in his eyes, which could be the champagne. Do you know? I've always known. So he's not mine?
No.
Simon slips the test tube into his pocket as Jack arrives wearing a Santa hat that is too small for his head. He puts his hand against the small of my back. In the old days, he would have hugged me, but now he is feeling his way back into my affections, always asking permission before crossing any threshold.
What are you two whispering about? He asks.
Babies, I say, leaning my head back to kiss his cheek.
We're not having any more, he says in mock horror.
Not us, I say, nodding towards Simon.
Really? Is Gina? No, says Simon. But you're having fun trying.
Good for you, says Jack. What took you so long?
I've been waiting for the right woman to come along, says Simon, giving me a sad, sweet smile.
Shooing them both out of the kitchen, I check the turkey and turn the potatoes. Ben makes a cooing sound and gives me a beautiful smile. His first. lighting up his eyes. He is a precious gift. An oops baby, who stumbled into the world and captivated a nation, which shone a spotlight onto our small, humdrum lives for a brief period. I don't know what they discovered, but certainly not a perfect marriage. That would be boring. We need the darkness to appreciate the light, and the bumps along the road to stop us falling asleep at the wheel. Will Jack and I last? I have no idea. We're together, and we're still in love, and we have three beautiful children. So I'm putting my money on silver, if not gold. Anniversaries, I mean. Whatever happens, we will always have Lucy and Lachlan and Ben. Children are like time capsules that we shoot into the future, hoping there will still be a world for them to inherit. I don't know if they are chips off the same block, or if one apple has fallen further from the tree. But what does it matter? They are loved, longed for. Ours. Agatha. The morning after I killed myself, I opened my eyes and saw the light angling through the blinds and felt the sheets against my skin and the cool air being drawn through my nostrils. Someone knocked on the door and pushed it open.
Good morning, Agatha. My name is Colin.
He carried a breakfast tray and his white uniform seemed to glow against his black skin. The tray had toast and scrambled eggs made with lots of parsley and a dollop of cream. Where am I? I asked.
You're in hospital.
Am I sick?
Your mind needs fixing.
Later, they let me go to the lounge where the staff had put up a Christmas tree with brightly coloured baubles and twinkling lights, and an angel perched at the very top. I looked out the window, which had vertical bars, and I saw the winter outside. In the afternoon I had a visitor, a nice man named Cyrus, who let me hold his hand as I told him about my life. Nobody had ever listened to me like that. Not my mother, or stepfather, or Mr. Bowler, or Nicky, or Hayden, or the fertility doctors, or the random men I took home and fucked, hoping to fall pregnant. Have you ever been to Tahiti? I asked him.
No. Have you?
Yes.
When?
I go there all the time.
Tell me about your other babies.
You'll never understand.
I'd like to try.
That evening, I sat in a wheelchair in front of the TV, listening to a choir sing Christmas carols, and I was glad that I didn't die.
What would you like to do tomorrow, Agatha? Asked Colin. We have yoga and Pilates, or you could do some planting in the greenhouse.
Oh, I can't do that, I said. My daughter's coming to visit. She's driving all the way from Leeds.
What's her name?
I don't know, but she's very pretty and clever, and she'll tell me her name when she gets here. On the morning after I killed myself, and the next morning, and the one after that, which was Christmas Day, I learned how to wait.
The Secrets She Keeps, a novel, was written by Michael Robotham and read by Lucy Price Lewis. This has been a presentation of Simon & Schuster Audio. The Secrets She Keeps, a novel, is available in print from Scribner.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.